Welcome. I'm Angie Coirer, filling in for Rose Aguilar today. This is Your Call. Joshua Kaplan is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for ProPublica. His new piece there is stunning. It's The Militia and the Mole: How a Mole Infiltrated the Highest Ranks of American Militias. It's the story of John Williams, not his real name, a wilderness survival trainer so outraged by January 6th, he went undercover for 2 years in some of the most influential right-wing militias in the U.S. One group, the Oath Keepers, openly and proudly showed its stripes at the Capitol riot. The other is AP3. The American Patriots 3% is deliberately less visible, but it's no less dangerous. It is well-armed. It's peopled by extremists throughout the country, including law enforcement officers, active military, even healthcare professionals. John Williams climbed the ranks of those groups aiming to undermine and expose their inner workings. He was remarkably successful until one day he feared he had shown his hand and he disappeared underground. As far as exposing the groups, he tried to contact multiple journalists. And my guest, Joshua Kaplan, says he was the only one who answered the call. He's been with ProPublica since 2020. In 2023, he and his colleagues revealed how a set of billionaires secretly provided decades of lavish gifts and luxury travel to Supreme Court justices. Those stories won the Pulitzer Prize for public service. They helped prompt the Supreme Court to adopt its first ever code of conduct. Let's talk about this Militia and the Mole article, his new piece, and his previous work looking inside militia groups arming themselves to either defend democracy as they see it or to destroy it, as we saw at the January 6th insurrection. Josh Kaplan, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to Your Call. Hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
What was your first exposure to John Williams?
So it came towards the end of his journey in these groups. Late 2022, he sent me this mysterious anonymous email. Like you said, he sent it to an array of reporters, but I was the only one to respond. And, you know, to be honest, I wasn't expecting much at first. I was skeptical. But we spoke a handful of times over encrypted calls. And then ultimately he sent me this package that contained a thumb drive with tens of thousands of secret documents, including dozens of hours of conversations that he'd covertly recorded.
If I can briefly make this all about you, that kind of thing must have sent your heart racing.
Oh, it was, I knew it was either going to be an incredible story or a lot of work to find out it wasn't. I was starting to look through these files. It was this kind of, you know, I've done reporting on the militia movement off and on since January 6th, but I'd never seen, you know, anything this extensive or anything with this kind of intimate feel to it, that anything that was quite so candid, as you know, it felt like I was sitting in the room of these, you know, some of these were historic meetings of incredibly prominent militias with just a dozen or so people there. And suddenly I had 6 hours of tape of what happened.
Wow. So you mentioned that he presented his own problems as a source. You had to look at his credibility, obviously, part of your job. And you point out that he treated deception as an art form. So how did you ultimately decide that his reports were trustworthy? Was it those tapes?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was the records. And this was a, you know, it was a vast amount of documentation, both the recordings I mentioned and also things like photographs, videos, years-long archives, just sprawling archives of internal chat logs from these militias. I would then go and try to independently confirm non-public details that were discussed on those tapes. And I was, you know, again and again and again able to authenticate these records through, you know, other sources that I've developed either in the militia movement or outside of it. Eventually, I had proof that the most important part of his story, the level of access that he obtained to these high-level militia members, And what that said about the militia movement and American politics right now, that was true and that was trustworthy. There's aspects of his story that are, harder to verify, and we could talk about those too. And we could talk about just how talented he is as a liar. But the fundamental thing, which is what he found, eventually, that became incontrovertible.
Well, it's interesting. You start the article at a place where he's fleeing from everything he has done. Now he's afraid for his own life. So I think the prevailing thought for me as I read it was, who does this? What kind of person does this? So who is John Williams? Where did he come from? And what were his motivations here?
Yeah, so John is, and I should say, this is actually his real name.
Oh, it
It's his
is.
legal. It's his legal name now. It's not the name he was born with, but
Ah.
it's part of his. I guess gives a window into his approach to his self appointed espionage. But John's a loner. He's extremely intelligent, well read, introspective. He's also incredibly intense about almost every aspect of his life and has this kind of Manichaean worldview that leaves little room for moderation. He had a very difficult childhood. He's gay, and he said that his father viewed that as a terrible sin. And even in his youth, he'd spend weeks at a time outside, in part just because he wanted to be at home as little as possible. And when he was a young adult, he was convicted of a series of crimes like assault and ultimately spent 3 years in prison. But during his sentence, he resolved to find a more productive way to channel that inner fervor. And when he got out, he was set on becoming a professional instructor in this long-standing passion of his, extreme wilderness survival. And he says that that's how he first crossed paths with these militias, that he was they reached out to him to do a survival training for him in 2019. He did it. They were, he was just happy to have a client. But he didn't, he said he found that unpleasant and decided not to work with them again. And that would have been the end of the story, except January 6 happened, the storming of the Capitol. And he was outraged and ashamed with himself for having helped these groups in some small way. And he decided to reach out back out to this militia he'd crossed paths with and to become a member as basically a freelance undercover operative.
He says in the article, you quote him as saying, "I couldn't have been as successful as this if I wasn't one of them in some respects. I couldn't have done it so long unless they recognized something in me." What about him did he have in common with the militiamen that we're about to hear about?
Well, I mean, one is, I think, this vigilante instinct that maybe is becoming a broader part of our culture. There's a lot of major, I don't want to make an equivalence between him and these militia guys, but I mean, these militias, one of the fundamental things they do is they try to shape the country through armed vigilante operations and armed action. That's not how John did it, but he has tried to, reshape the country through betrayals and lies. Through he did, he didn't trust the authorities to handle this problem. He didn't trust the authorities to work with him. He tried to take this all on his own. Operating without the guardrails or kind of ethical boundaries that come with working with the government. And then he also, I mean, he has, these interests in survivalism and in kind of, the taboo. He was able to inhabit the character of a enthusiastic militia member, at least, with extraordinary success.
So let's get into the meat of what he found. And as we talk about this, I want to point people to another ProPublica piece that you wrote, and this was previous to the election, Armed and Underground Inside the Turbulent Secret World of an American Militia. And the article that you wrote, having interviewed John and having researched all of his work, we have primarily AP3 and the Oath Keepers. And AP3 comes across as arguably more of a threat to all of us because it operates on a quieter basis. Scott Seddon founded AP3. So what were his motivations and goals?
Scott Seddon?
Mm-hmm.
So Scott Seddon is this he was briefly a soldier in the Army Reserve. He was a ex-model. He's a fascinating figure. In Obama's first term, he was terrified by the direction of the country, and he decided to start his own militia, American Patriots 3%, which eventually became one of the largest militias in the country, with a presence in every state or almost every state, likely tens of thousands of members. I'll talk more about the different things that AP3 does, but one of the things that's interesting about it is Seddon has never actually defined the purpose of his militia. And I think that's very common for militias these days. There's no kind of clear set angle. There's a lot of shared grievances, and there's a lot of kind of activities that define this group of firearms training, paramilitary training, but whether the goal here is to be a kind of glorified gun club in your community, or to commit mass political violence against the government, that's an open question, and a question that is constantly being argued about in AP3 and groups like this. And I think that kind of that malleability of the central mission is one of the reasons that groups, that modern militias today, have been able to get so much larger than militias in the past, and to be able to kind of morph themselves into like chameleons as the political winds in the country have been shifting.
It's fascinating when you read about AP3 to find out they really present themselves as something of a society improving association. They do things on a civic level for their neighborhoods and for their neighbors. And there's a lot of contrast between AP3 and the Oath Keepers, critically, in that AP3 deliberately kept a very low profile on January 6th. We saw the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, and they were right out there. And AP3 kept all their involvement. If any of their members were there, they were there under, as part of their own decision. They weren't there officially as AP3. What went into that decision?
Part of it, I think, is seemingly just dumb luck. AP3 had decided that it was going to have all of its members mobilize on Washington 2 weeks after January 6th for the inauguration. And they were putting an enormous amount of energy into that. And Scott Seddon decided to focus his resources there rather than going en masse on January 6th. But plenty of members went anyways in state chapters, organized to go as a group. Some members fought with police on the Capitol steps that day. But they were under instructions to not wear their patches. And the effect of this, and this is something that's happened in other cases with AP3 too, is that, even when these people went and in some cases quite brutally assaulted police officers, and there are some that have been arrested for that, they weren't linked back to AP3. AP3, unlike the Oath Keepers, never had to deal with all the ramifications of being publicly linked to what happened on January 6th.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the makeup of these organizations. And neither you nor I think any of the readers would be surprised to hear that the law enforcement personnel show up in these groups and military members show up in these groups. But it's more shocking to hear that, for example, there was the head of a United Health subsidiary who was there. And there are doctors and there are white collar workers. And talk about the makeup of these groups.
Yeah, it's a really disparate group of people. Because you have some people who have avowed white nationalist ties, but you also have, some members who are Black and Hispanic and very conservative, but obviously would not fit in a white nationalist group. You have convicted criminals with incredibly serious criminal records alongside very successful doctors and government attorneys and businessmen. It was a surprise to me to learn about some of these doctors. The doctor who's in a high level leadership role in the Oath Keepers even after January 6th. They take a lot. They are very purposeful of when it comes to how to keep that very, very wide range of people united under one roof. And at least, while there's some arguments about what exactly they're going to do with all of this, working towards one goal.
It's kind of a backhanded compliment, but you got to give it to a leader who is able to stand in front of a group that consists in part of white supremacists and in part of Black Americans and keep them together as a force, at least to some uncomfortable extent.
Yeah, no, I think something that's like a surprise to outsiders. I think indicative of, the ways, this part of the hard right has evolved in recent years. I think broadly, while there are certainly incredibly dangerous white nationalist groups still on the scene, I think more and more organizations have oriented themselves where the kind of issue of first concern is national politics, which is not something we saw in, say, the 90s.
Mm-hmm. One of the key figures in the piece is Bobby Kinch, and he described his vision for the Oath Keepers in American life as a two-edged sword. What did he mean?
Yes, so there's the dull edge, which is basically traditional, more or at least relatively traditional grassroots political work. Examples he gave are things like trying to combat, so-called election fraud. And he had this, grand ambition that 5 or 10 years, the Oath Keepers will be a place where conservative candidates for public office come seeking the Oath Keepers' endorsement. And then the sharp edge was paramilitary training. I think I'm paraphrasing slightly, but he said, when the dull edge fails, you have to be able to turn that around and be sharp.
Mm. He was motivated by a very creepy Ernest Hemingway quote. There is no hunting like the hunting of man. Those who have hunted armed men long enough and liked it never really care for anything else. Okay, big wow. Does that motivation make him an outlier, or is that express some kind of common point of view within the group?
Well, what I found fascinating about that was I think, Bobby Kinch is a really interesting case study in why so many police officers and ex-police officers join these groups that are, contain a bunch of criminals in them. Bobby Kinch was this career detective out of Las Vegas who served in elite units. Burned out of the department after some scandal that involved him posting on Facebook that he would welcome a race war. But he says that he, when he got a new job at a sportsman's warehouse, he had this, urge that he wasn't done yet, and so he joined the Oath Keepers. And in these tapes, I mean, you could really sense this nostalgia he has for the thrill of police work, the excitement of the armed actions that he used to be sanctioned for. They used to be his genuine, commendable job to do, and that he is in some way, perhaps recreating that now in this paramilitary context.
I have to ask, and it's beyond the purview of the two articles we're discussing, but it's not uncommon to know that law enforcement and military members are in these groups. Within the article, we talk about, for example, there's a sheriff who's involved, and there are connections to an attorney general involved. And I wonder if you've looked into any efforts, if they exist among law enforcement or the military, to cut off this kind of mentality in their group and to look out for this mindset and to, get them out of authority, positions of authority. Are you aware of any of those?
I mean, so it's a I think it varies a lot from department to department, of course, especially with police at the local, where everything's local. The military is an interesting one. I mean, the broad trend with the military has been that when there is some catastrophic national event, that's when they say, okay, now we are banning involvement in the organization, the sort of organizations that were responsible for it. And you saw this, only it took I believe it took the Oklahoma City bombing for the military to say it is completely unacceptable to be a member of a white nationalist group and be an active duty U.S. service member. And I know that after January 6th, active duty military were told you can't be members of groups like the Proud Boys, like the Oath Keepers. And so, I think some critics would say that these sort of policy shifts have come too late. And there's a lot of reasons to be concerned about the presence in of active duty service members in organizations like this, especially the more criminally minded organizations. Now, how proactive the military has been in actually policing those policies, policing those bans, I think is more of an open question that I don't know the answer to.
Talking with Joshua Kaplan about not one but two pieces he's produced for ProPublica. The new one is The Militia and the Mole: How a Mole Infiltrated the Highest Ranks of American Militias. And prior to the election, he wrote Armed and Underground: Inside the Turbulent Secret World of an American Militia. I'm in for Rose Aguilar today and would very much like to invite your contributions to this conversation. Our phone lines are open for your questions and comments. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. While we have Josh on the line, what would you like to know about the members of the groups, about the group's construction, their aims, and what they're actually getting done toward their aims? What about John Williams' works, your impressions of that? What are your concerns about the relationships of these groups to Donald Trump, as we saw demonstrated in the January 6th insurrection, and to law enforcement and the military, as we were just discussing? And especially if you have any personal exposure to an extremist militia, we'd very much like to hear your story. 866-798-TALK is the phone line. 866-798-8255. We'll also check your email. We're here for you there at yourcall@kalw.org. Either way, your contributions are more than welcome. I'm Angie Carrero here on KALW. We'll be right back with more of your call. Welcome back to Your Call, where we're talking with ProPublica reporter Josh Kaplan. If you've joined us mid-discussion, you can hear our entire interview online after the show. Our episodes are available on our podcast page at yourcallradio.org. Josh, in your earlier article that ran before the election, you went into the actions of militias at the border. And let me read an excerpt here, and we refer first to the AP3 founder. Seddon sounded a call to arms in late 2021. Illegal border crossings were surging, and the Texas governor had declared his state was abandoned by the federal government. "Our country is being invaded at the southern border," Seddon said. "Haitians, Middle Easterners, South American invaders that are coming in." He had about 20 members preparing to deploy to Kamado, Texas, and was seeking more volunteers. Anyone interested would need to bring an AR-15-style carbine and a semi-automatic pistol. They would conduct vigilante patrols. Another leader explained the rules. "It is a felony to detain these folks under Texas law," he said. "We can only report to the authorities, but we are allowed to carry live rounds." Many members said they didn't want to go if they couldn't kill migrants. One leader told Seddon, "The most heard comment I get is there's only one way to stop them." These are the extremists among the extremists, are they not?
I think that's a good way of putting it. I mean, it's this was the case with the border, and it's the case with these groups more broadly. There are these, while they do these dangerous vigilante operations, like going to the border and conducting armed patrols where they round up migrants to turn over to the authorities, there is this constant drumbeat of heated debate inside AP3 of whether they should escalate things even further and commit acts of mass political violence. And it's, it's always when someone's calling to arms, it's, I mean, this is the challenge FBI agents face. Most of the time those conversations don't turn into anything, but it's hard to know when they could. And obviously the consequences of that would be absolutely massive. And so AP3, even in the period I was looking at, the year since January 6th, those debates got more intense over time, and it got to the point where even longtime senior members of the group, who are not people who are easily rattled by a little tough talk, were quitting because they were scared by the number of high-level leaders in the organization advocating for committing acts of terrorism.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to look into, as you did, the politics within the organization, not just as we were just talking about, not just what movements are effective to accomplish their goals, but to see the machinations inside, who gets ousted, who rises to the top. John Williams was able to talk his way into a top position, which ousted someone else. And in a sense, they're like any other political organization.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're incredibly... I mean, it's incredibly political, and there's all sorts of internal feuds. I mean, Scott Seddon even ultimately kind of lost his handle on the group for a number of reasons, but one of which was that his big claims about his time in the military turned out to be false, and someone found that out and kind of exposed the secret. And so he started losing his ability to keep people under him.
When you talk about the effects within the group, one of our callers notes off the air, right-wing militias have been with us since the 1970s, possibly to challenge other groups such as the Weather Underground or the SLA. How have they changed in their goals and tactics? Josh?
It's a fantastic question. I mean, I think, the militias in the, first few decades of the modern militia movement, so the 70s through the 90s, they were primarily local in nature. There weren't the sort of these national organizations we see today, like AP3 and the Oath Keepers. And their primary activity was going off in the woods and doing things with guns. And obviously they would sometimes commit acts of violence that they'd been training for. But it was a fairly small amount, like a fairly small range of activities that they did, and they were generally anti-government in nature. Kind of direct, like that was the purpose of their mission, was opposing the U.S. government in some ways. Now these organizations have gotten a lot, the ones that they can get a lot larger, more people, more of a footprint, and their activities have gotten a lot, their ambit has gotten has sprawled, and so you start seeing more of the blurring of the lines between militias and mainstream politics. And you start getting things like militias making a concerted push to get their members in positions of local elected office, sometimes successfully. I mean, this matters for a range of reasons, but it's, I mean, that sort of, getting involved in politics, that's not something that militias of the 90s would have ever done. And you also start seeing, things like these militias that are in the streets of the armed patrols at Black Lives Matter rallies, going to progressive or left-wing protests and getting in street brawls with, activists from the other side. And so that kind of being out in the open or out and involved in things that are happening in the world, in the cities, in politics, not in the woods. That's I think one of the distinguishing features of the post-Obama iteration of the movement.
It's interesting that our caller brings up the prior history of infiltrations like this, because of course there was infiltration of the Black Panthers at the time, and here there is, in your article about John Williams, a militia leader once dispatched him to a Democratic Socialists of America meeting at a local library, he said, where he saw a Proud Boy he recognized from a joint militia training. Was this a closet right-winger keeping tabs on the socialists, or a closet leftist who might dox him or inform the police? And there's that whole spy versus spy, cloak and dagger. Who's here? What's their motivation? Are they going to turn me in? There's that. In a sense, it's an echo of the old times with who was infiltrating whom.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's I mean, there is a I mean, even John Williams himself, I mean, he's part of this kind of larger Cold War of radical versus radical that, often stays out of view. But I mean, there are other vigilantes, left-wing vigilantes who have gone undercover in militias, in white nationalist groups, with the goal, not coordinating with law enforcement, with the goal of damaging these organizations from the inside. That's not something that usually gets told on the record, but it is a wider phenomenon that's been happening in the shadows. And as John found out, the same thing is happening in the opposite direction. These militias trying to get inside local leftist organizations.
We had talked about the level of violence that it has potential here, and we talked about how precarious John Williams' situation was, and now we can put those two together. There's actually an incident described in the story about how he was carrying a bug at one point, and the bug was seized by a puppy who started running around the room with it while he's supposed to be undercover. Tell that story. It's just riveting.
Oh, yes. So, John was sleeping in the home of the new national leader of the Oath Keepers, going through his files in the middle of the night. I mean, he was just getting and he brought this bug along so that when he was having conversations with the nationalist with the Oath Keeper Bobby Kinch, or when he was they're going to go to a leadership meeting for the Oath Keepers the next day, he'd be able to record. And in the morning before the meeting, they were having coffee together in the kitchen, and Kinch's dog snatched the bug out of John's bag, and they noticed this at the same time. And Bobby started going to take the bug, take whatever, take this device out of the dog's mouth. And if you look closely at this bug, it looks like a USB drive from afar, but if you look closely, there's signs, there's a little on-off switch, there's microphone holes. And so John's thinking this might be how I get find out, how I get found out. And this is a man that he is terrified of. And so he starts looking around and sees his host's gun sitting on the kitchen counter and thinks, if he even starts to look at it, I'm gonna grab the gun, I'm gonna shoot him, and then I'm gonna flee in the woods. And Bobby goes and he takes the bug out of the dog's mouth, and then he just hands it right to Williams and starts to apologize. And John says, "Don't worry about it. He's a puppy." And they move on, and their relationship continued for months after that, seemingly without Bobby knowing that he had been in a incredibly perilous situation that morning.
Wow. Another off-air caller didn't want to go on the air, but did want to ask, are these militias willing and able to threaten, or worse, go after regular people who oppose Trump? Do we know that?
So I think what this listener might be asking is, should I be afraid of expressing my political views that I'll, have militiamen show up on my doorstep? And I don't want to overstate the threat here. I think that's exceedingly unlikely for a normal person expressing their political views to experience any sort of armed backlash. These are not, these groups are not, they are widespread, but they're not everywhere. And while they, have committed acts of violence, it is not, they're not attacking citizens in their community at home with impunity. And these are not people who want to get arrested over something like that. But there is a low boil menace to, how these groups approach their adversaries. So I mean, one example that did happen in this story is, John found out about the Oath Keepers were keeping tabs on local journalists in Utah, where they're based, that they thought were, potentially enemies of theirs. And so a columnist who'd kind of aggressively covered groups trying to combat quote unquote election fraud, or a student journalist who'd gone to one of their protests, and they built dossiers on these people with some kind of alarming language in them, and their home address and their phone numbers, and they did a stakeout and identified this student journalist's car. And for John, it was this very very scary moment, because you couldn't tell, is this a threat, or is that all they're going to do, or is this going to get turn into something even worse and turn into violence? And he decided to try to warn these journalists. And so, I mean, I think that's a representative kind of example of the sort of danger these groups pose that doesn't tend to make headlines, is local figures who express views that they don't agree with. They they can, you know, they have, they take steps to oppose them that at least threaten to bubble over into violence at any time. Now, that said, you know, these journalists are okay. The militias didn't try anything, to my knowledge, and I know that these journalists are fine, and you know, didn't have this happen to them, anything happen to them. And so if anyone's asking, should I feel like I can't, you know, put a sign in my yard because of supporting my favorite candidate because of militias, I don't think that that is, you know, we are very, 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 very far away from that point.
And this puts me in mind of Jane Mayer's book on dark money when she was investigating the Kochs, as were the FBI in a parallel investigation. And both of them were followed by the Kochs. They would see, you know, secret cars at night following them around. And I can't help but think that you have to think yourself about this kind of coverage, what you're putting out there, and whether they target you. Do you give that some thought? Have you heard anything?
Always give that some thought, you know. I mean, just doing investigative journalism these days, I think, especially on, you know, contentious issues. It's you know, I don't want to get into too many details, but you know, one takes steps.
So let's move over to Donald Trump. He's going to be taking the oath of office again before you know it. And he and members of the militias and the Republicans, they've all worked to rewrite the history of the Capitol attack. So who's working out there to counter the revisionist history? How effective do you think they've been at turning this into some sort of celebration of American democracy?
January 6th. Oh, incredibly successful. I mean, you know, I think it's easy to forget at this point that, you know, even in mainstream MAGA politics, there was a time after January 6th where the Capitol rioters and the sort of militias that were involved in it were pariahs. And I don't think anyone foresaw at the time that that was ever going to change. It was an incredibly violent day. You know, even leaders inside these militias thought that they might not be able to survive the backlash, that, you know, the movement would more or less go extinct after January 6th. But of course, Trump and his allies have been very successful at rewriting this narrative, particularly within the Republican Party, and you know, by the and that had that messaging has had a measurable real world impact on these groups. You know, by the summer of 2021, as Trump and other prominent politicians were starting to change their tune and talk about the rioters as patriots and political prisoners, that had a very concrete impact on militias. Suddenly, you had people starting to join again because and saying that January 6th actually inspired them to join, and it really helped put the wind back in their sails. You know, these militias that had felt like they were on their deathbed just a few months before, or were, you know, before long they were getting so many recruits that they were struggling to keep up.
You know, I know it's been established by a number of investigations that when you talk about, for example, white nationalists, sometimes they attract people who aren't really white supremacists. They aren't attracting supremacists per se. They're attracting lonely people who feel misunderstood, who are craving community, and then they gradually become supremacists because that's where they find their community. What's your sense of within these organizations, how many of them are true believers or how many of them are just, you know, rebels looking for a cause?
Great question. I mean, and it's, you know, I think there's a lot of shared views. How many, you know, I mean, one of the, like, there's, I couldn't say for sure, you know, it's a breakdown. But one of the reasons that these militias have been so successful is that growing to a size that would have been unimaginable prior to the modern iteration of the militia movement is that they are really good at making this a you know so that it becomes one of the most fulfilling things in many of their members' lives. As you said at the earlier on, I mean, these militias do community service where they're giving food to the homeless, much like a Rotary Club. They celebrate holidays together. They had AP3 had a magazine with children's word games in the back, and militia news in the front. They have classes where they teach each other how to garden. And then they also have the paramilitary training where they practice shooting targets with sniper rifles from half a mile away and storming into buildings together with semi-automatic guns. Taken as a whole, I mean, it becomes one of the main reasons people like one of the key draws is ideology, of course, to these organizations, but camaraderie is absolutely a huge part of it. People meet, military veterans who have been, ever since they left the service, been searching for that incredibly tight-knit bond with that they'd felt with their squad when they were serving overseas. Some of them drift into militias because they find that. They find the closest approximation to that they've seen inside the militia. And that absolutely can, people then will drift more towards the extreme wing of the militia over time as they are exposed to these ideas, are kind of begin to live and breathe in this world.
Well, in fact, you write in one of the articles that if Trump pardons January 6th rioters, such a move could trigger a renaissance for military extremists, sending them an unprecedented message of protection and support. So who's charged with preparing for that? Who's minding the store here? And what gaps do you see in preparation for that growth of militias?
Who's minding the store? That's a really interesting question right now. I mean, of course, the Bureau has historically done with some very notable exceptions, such as January 6, has done a good job of monitoring organizations before they go out and commit acts of terrorism. They foil a lot of plots. The larger and more volatile the movement gets, the harder I'm sure it is for the Bureau to monitor everything. Speaking of pardons, I mean, Trump's proposed pick for to lead the FBI is Kash Patel, who has been an advocate for pardons, has been led an organization to support January 6 rioters who are in prison. He actually was one of the producers, I believe, on the version of the national anthem Trump used at his campaign rallies, where the singers were January 6 defendants sitting in jail. And so that's another form of this very unprecedented message of protection and support. And I'm not saying that that means the FBI is, we don't know what that's actually going to look like in practice in terms of how the federal government approaches these groups. And I don't want to speculate on that. But in terms of the messaging, which, as we were just talking about, has very, very concrete ramifications, especially if these pardons are so sweeping that they include pardons for people who were convicted of assaulting police officers in brutal ways that day, as Trump has repeatedly suggested they might. How that will be interpreted by a lot of people, experts fear, is that as a license for more extreme action, as a statement that even serious crimes will not be punished potentially if you commit them for the quote unquote right cause.
I wonder how that's going to go over with the law enforcement officers within the militias.
It's a really interesting question. No, I mean, there's these internal tensions and contradictions that are fascinating and unpredictable. I've spent a lot of time trying to unspool them, but it's there some contradictions are irresolvable.
One last question. We don't want to leave John Williams out of this. Last we heard from him, he fled because he felt he had exposed himself as a mole. And I wonder if you're free to say to some extent what he's doing now, how he's occupying himself, what he plans to do next. Any insight there?
So, I mean, to stick with what's in the story, I mean, it's he's going on the record because he wants to, he thinks the most effective way for him to damage these groups, which is what he wants, is to tell his story, and to kind of sow paranoia and distrust and make it so that, he's a sort of boogeyman tale for the militia movement, that every time these guys go to a meeting together, they'll be thinking in the back of their head, this guy will betray me. And then in terms of his more concrete plans, he's also released a significant portion of his files online on Monday, the January 6th anniversary, a couple days after the story was published. And he's hoping that that will be useful for local activists, for law enforcement. And he told me that his plan now is to keep doing this sort of vigilante work against these groups indefinitely. And just even, he hopes to even start his own sort of vigilante collective where he's working with others and running his own, quote unquote, undercover agents inside the far right.
Wow. Joshua Kaplan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Josh Kaplan's new piece is The Militia and the Mole, How a Mole Infiltrated the Highest Ranks of the American Militias. You can find that online at ProPublica. You can also find it here. We'll post a link at kalw.org. You can hear our entire interview online after the show. Nina Kissinger produced today. Kevin Vance is our engineer. Thanks to Malihe Razazan. I'm Angie Caro. Thanks for tuning in to Your Call.